We're told gauging a forest's resilience may start with something as simple as a berry, whether blue, straw, huckle, or cran, or wild leeks, or wild rice, fiddleheads, or morel mushrooms. Their flourishing presence or regrettable absence can signify much about an ecosystem's health and not a little about the human attention to such small, delectable details. That reminder opens the East and Midwest section of the handsome volume America's Great National Forests, Wildernesses, and Grasslands by Char Miller, with photography by Tim Palmer. And the layout of the book underscores the arc in our experience of this magnificent legacy. The scale from the sublime to the most particular. On page one, we hold our breath as we behold a fresh snowstorm that blankets Douglas firs and western hemlocks along the upper Rogue River in the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. On the very last page, a blue grouse perches among the conifers in Montana's Flathead National Forest, and we're close enough to see the reflection in the berry-like eye of this beautiful bird. Dr. Miller reminds us, too, the working nature of these forests in this country is what distinguishes them from national parks. The National Park Service's mission is to preserve the natural and cultural resources and values of the national park system for the enjoyment, education, and inspiration of this and future generations. The distinction between the two agencies is often sharply drawn between the Forest Service and its utilitarian focus and the Park Service's preservation ethic, but it can be overdrawn. The Forest Service pursues many of the same management goals as the Park Service because it too is required to protect endangered species and wild and scenic rivers, and to manage national monuments, national recreation areas, and wildernesses according to the same regulatory statutes. The key difference is that the Forest Service's congressionally mandated multiple-use focus means the national forests are also locations of production for timber, power, water, grazing, and minerals. Dr. Miller is the W.M. Keck Professor of Environmental Analysis at Pomona College in California. He is the author of the award-winning study Gifford Pinchot and the Making of Modern Environmentalism. And he is senior fellow of the Pinchot Institute for Conservation. Dr. Miller is one of this country's foremost scholars on the Progressive Era's conservation movement, and his work brings him often to northeastern Pennsylvania and to Gray Towers in Milford, the family home of Gifford Pinchot, the first chief of the U.S. Forest Service, who served two times as the governor of Pennsylvania. With Earth Day still in the headlines, we had a chance to speak by phone with Char Miller about his recent book and his ties to Gifford Pinchot and to our region.
First of all, it's really fun to be back on the show and to talk with you about national forests, but also sort of public lands and the history of those incredible spaces. And I would say that I owe a lot of this to Gifford Pinchot, who, though dead many, many years, continues to influence the way I think about land, that he and Teddy Roosevelt and John Muir and a host of women and other folks gave to us, in effect, a legacy that's unbelievable. And one of those legacies from sort of the Pinchot family is Gray Towers in Milford, which if folks who are listening to this have not been to, they really need to go. Not least because it tells you what a little bit of money could have purchased back in the day, in the 1880s when it was constructed, but also because it's not just a physical space, it's also a landmark landscape. And it's in that space that that particular family and then generations of the family and those of us who love it have gathered in various ways to talk about, argue over, debate, maybe sometimes yell at each other, and also eat and drink to, you know, sort of dream about what it means to value lands and their incredible contributions to our society, which are issues that Gifford's parents thought about, his grandparents thought about, he thought about, and subsequent generations have really worked to sustain across time. So if we're going to locate this conversation in Milford around Gray Towers, I'm thrilled because I think for me at least, it's one of the places where I came to better understand not only Gifford Pinchot, but many of the issues that confront landscapes far away from Gray Towers, as far away as the Angeles National Forest, which out of my office window I get to gaze upon every day.
And I love the story that you tell about Gifford Pinchot's resting place, that he didn't want it manicured.
Yeah, it is compelling, and it was something that I thought about even before I wrote first the biography of him, Gifford Pinchot and the Making of Modern Environmentalism, and then the subsequent book, Seeking the Greatest Good, The Conservation Legacy of Pinchot, which is really not about Pinchot, but I thought, what a cool way to start a book, which is to talk about this guy and his burial site. Because he gets confused by some folks who think of him only as a forester, and thus as a forester is kind of, guilty of, sort of creating the notion that trees are things that we manage for board feet, which is true, but also because of the way in which he really felt that nature ought to be unmanicured in other ways. And, in the most manicured of spaces, a cemetery, he wanted grass to grow. He wanted trees to grow, unruly as they may be. And it's Seeking the Greatest Good actually opens up with a group of foresters who were staying at Gray Towers and having a long conversation about environmental issues back in the day, but who also went to his gravesite like an homage, but were confused by it. And were confused because they expected manicured and regulated and controlled, and Pinchot went, not here. And they really had to think deeply about why he did what he did, which is, I think, actually his point. I mean, he's still teaching from the grave, I guess is the way to think about it.
I had an image of a web. As we walk in the forest, sometimes we come across those enormous spider webs that you can see either the dew or the light behind them. And that's what I think about your interests and about what you do in all of your writing. You give us that ecological sense that everything's connected to everything else. And in this book, it is that way, where you give us a sense that it's not just trees. It's culture, it's people, it's politics, it's fire, it's water. It's a way of understanding ourselves, I think, ultimately.
Yes. Lovely. So America's Great National Forest has this really interesting genesis, and then the book that came from it, which I have to say is absolutely gorgeous, and that's not because of my prose, but of the photographs of Tim Palmer, which are really quite stunning. You know, this was funded by the Forest Service, and then they said, go away, do your work. And, they gave us free leeway to do whatever it is we wanted to do with this project. And so, A, credit the agency for not only helping to get Tim into the field, and he spent a year photographing around the country while sending me these gorgeous photographs, and I'm sitting in my office typing, like, who got the better job here? It's pretty darn clear. But one of the things that Tim and I were wrestling with even before he went off, and we sat in outside my office with a big table and sort of mapped out sort of his trip, but also the way in which we were thinking about this project, was to lead with the aesthetics, to lead with the ecological, to remind people that in the Forest Service, at least, there's 193 million acres of national forests and grasslands with a lot of wilderness and a lot of other spaces. But, part of the argument is that the extraordinary beauty of these lands are, as you sort of opened it, they're not just vast and big and overwhelming, though they are that. They're also, as I've come to understand them at least, regardless of where you are, whether you're in Los Angeles and you're looking up at the mountains and knowing or even not knowing that they're managed by the Forest Service, or you're in Denver, or you're out in north central western Pennsylvania where the Allegheny is, or you're down in Florida, or where almost anywhere you are, there's only six or seven states that don't have national forests, they really are local. They really are the place to which people go, not just for recreation, although they do that. It's just like they want to take a hike, or they want to hunt, or they want to fish. Or, in the case of mineral extraction, that happens also. I mean, they're really working landscapes, working aesthetically, but also in an economic sense. But we wanted to lead with their beauty, to remind people that these places kind of overwhelm in that way. And Tim's photograph does that. What my text is trying to do is to get at a different story, which is, yes, beautiful, yes, amazing, but these places have a history, ecological as well as human, and the human and the ecological are bound up with one another. And I have to say that although it was not intentional, there were kind of two sort of touchstones that emerged for me as I was writing them. The first of which is their localness. That is to say, that as much as we tell the story of Gifford Pinchot and Teddy Roosevelt and John Muir and these sort of great figures who, from on high, sort of directed things, or so we imagine, it turns out there's a lot of local stories about people who lived underneath these mountains and valued their clean water, valued their open spaces, valued the services that they provided these communities in the West, and then in time over time the East. And secondly, that on all of those places over which there has been a heck of a lot of debate, which it was really fun to write about, by the way, because those help narrate a story, right? To have these sort of critical flashpoints that help us understand what's going on. But part of the way contemporary Americans are now dealing with the debates is through collaboration, through cooperation, through a kind of give and take that Pinchot and Roosevelt understood also. And many of the progenitors of these particular terrains had to deal with in the early part of the 20th century, we're still dealing with. And that, I think, is a telling point. These places have always been debated. They've always been argued over. And that's why they're called public lands. And I think they are, for me at least, sort of signals that in nature is how we find democracy. In the natural world is also a mirror for the political discourse that defines that natural world, or at least in part. Nature has its own role to play, to be sure, but we really have, it's sort of like, I don't know, Socrates' symposia, right? This is the place where we go and say, all right, what do you actually believe? And we're doing it up against a natural world that at times cares and at times doesn't care what we think we know.
You also weave in those chapter headings or those italicized pauses that allow us to enter into what stories you're going to tell that do give us the clues about how to weigh these issues. For example, again, the scale question about the vastness and yet the backyard nature. Just that lovely quote about the precariousness sometimes of a forest, or what we can learn about a forest in the health of a berry, the presence of a crayon, or when you quote Barry Lopez and you say, how do we locate meaning in any single spot? Will you give us a sense of the ripples of the meaning? It's not just the botanical meaning.
Yeah, no, that's right. And yet, you know, that was part of what I was learning also as I was writing, which was also how to write about these places that make it palpable, touchable for the rest of us. And, you know, sort of reading Lopez, reading Robin Kimmerer and others, made it pretty clear to me, as I've been trying to do in my own work, that place-based sort of analyses, that is to say, what's happening in the community in which we live, and that might be as massive as Los Angeles is, more likely for folks who live in and around national forests. It's not quite that big and sort of overwhelming in scale, but even in a place like Los Angeles, you can get off the beaten path so fast and get up into wild lands that take your breath away. And I was trying to figure out, like, what's the way to help people see that? And in some cases, it's about berries. In some cases, it's about a tree. In some cases, it's about a river or a creek. And in other places, it might be a particular debate erupting around, you know, whether you can squirrel hunt in the Monongahela National Forest. And if you can't, why not? And what do people do when a Forest Service in the 1960s sort of clear cuts your hunting grounds, your traditional hunting grounds, and what do you do with it? Well, it turns out you sue. And it turned out in that particular case, they won. And it turned out as a result of them winning, the Forest Service had to completely change its modus operandi, the way at which it operated. It didn't like that, but it had to. And so, you know, a barrel of a gun or a fishing hook or a plant or just rushing water begins to open up larger stories. And I found that so much fun to work on as I was trying to write these stories in ways that would give people a richer appreciation of these places that we know as our public lands, but maybe not think about all that much. And here was a way to help us cogitate a bit about why they matter and why we should care about them.
And you give us a story, for example, in that way, tying us to a history of our country. And that's the story you tell about the Japanese internment camps and the dust.
Yes.
And that the camps were there at the base of the mountains.
Yes. That I have to credit one of my students, because her grandmother was interned at Manzanar. She wrote a spectacular senior thesis that sort of did this very interesting location of Manzanar inside, you know, all of these issues in that particular, in the Owens River Valley. And I had been up there at the camp, and I was sort of looking towards the Sierra Mountains, which you see on their eastern slope, the most arid part of those mountains, and suddenly had this recognition, this moment, thinking about my student's work, and I went, wait. That was the backdrop against which her grandmother spent 3 years in this internment camp. And I went, I got to tell that story. You know, it was a way to pay homage to her grandmother and also to my student's work without naming it. But, you know, I've told her, you know, you got to go read that chapter because it's really about you. You know, so these little stories popped up and ways of capturing things that I'm so pleased that you responded that way, because that was my hope. You know, you write these things and you never know how people are going to read them. But it was helpful for me because it really put me in time and place, which is really useful as a writer, but also made a story more vibrant, I hope, that when you tell the story about the Inyo National Forest on the eastern slope of the Sierra, it's got not a happy set of remembrances that I think adds to its poignancy.
When you talk about writing, it makes me think about your role trying to find a way to tell us about this, and how do you do that? And you mentioned a fellow named John Gifford who wrote reports, and even he couldn't hold himself back at one point in the report, and he let himself go. But so often we get these statistical, dry, data-driven analyses, and we need more of the Goethe kind of approach where the experience, it doesn't mean it isn't scientific in a certain way, but there's more of the human experience in this.
Yes. Yeah, John Gifford's report, which I suspect he wrote and I read, is really interesting because he was writing a report about El Yunque National Forest, or what would become El Yunque National Forest in Puerto Rico. And it actually, as it turns out, is the oldest national forest because it was actually designated by the King of Spain before the United States took it over in 1898 and before, therefore, we had forest reserves. But I was reading his report in part because I was trying to figure out this space and the only tropical forest that we have inside the national forest system. And I'm starting to read his report, and it is so dry, you know, because he was trying to articulate what was going on in this landscape. But also, you know, when he started to go crazy, and it's not really crazy, but he's getting really interested in the space itself. And I went, huh, that's interesting. He's writing this dry report, and suddenly the landscape forces him to use terms that he wouldn't ordinarily use to describe the sort of the really sharp-edged ridges that he was trying to scramble up, the trees he didn't understand. And, you know, I won't say I was there with him in a sense, but I was trying to figure out how to see like he was seeing. And it got very exciting as a result of that, because he let himself go. And as you say, Goethe-like, sort of the romantic urge struck him even as he's writing fairly turgid scientific prose that would be read by Pinchot and others when his report came back in. That was a moment that was really important for me, because not unlike Thoreau and others who at various moments let loose, it's the moment when they let loose that you go, oh, this is interesting, because it meant that they were shaken. They were sort of jolted out of their science nest. And that becomes an interesting story to tell.
And what does this do in your telling the story, for example, about the squirrel hunting, for the squirrel hunters among those who are going to read the book who might not be inclined to even talk in florid vocabulary about a place that they really love and they bond with?
Yeah, I think what it may tell us, and this is true, you know, for those who have fought for wilderness, for those who think we should actually do more mining and do more oil exploration and the like, as well as those for whom these landscapes are cultural, that is to say, they berry pick, they hunt, they fish. At some level, all of this is about coming to terms with a landscape that has resources that we might want, that has meaning that's beyond just that resource. And I think for those particular hunters in the late 1960s, which was also true for others out in Missoula and elsewhere, is the way in which they are at once conservation-minded, but also resource exploitators, let's call them. You know, folks who, again, hunters and fisher folk in particular, will recognize themselves in that particular story because they love these places. There is no doubt in my mind about their ardor about that landscape and also their presence within it. And someone like Aldo Leopold is a classic case of one of the great conservationist thinkers who was also a hunter. Turns out so was Roosevelt, so was Pinchot. And it is through that intimate connection with the landscape that they come to some larger conclusions about why we need to protect it, in part because they wanted to continue to hunt, to be sure, but also because they felt that these were invaluable resources that went way beyond their own particular time and interest and need in that regard. And I think that's one of the things that this book and the writing of it helped reinforce for me, which is we really owe those preceding generations an enormous debt for their foresightedness. For those in the 1880s and 90s who, before Pinchot and Roosevelt came on the scene, argued that we really need to have these landscapes and then gifted them to us, like, what a legacy. And we don't pay a lot of attention to that, but I think we ought to. I think we really ought to, in part because we're in a climate-charged environment now. And the question the book, if not directly, indirectly poses to those of us who open that book and start to read it is, okay, they did that for us. What are we going to do for our great-grandchildren? How are we going to give to them landscapes that have so captured our attention and our imagination over the last 115, 120 years? What are we going to do? And I think that's an open question, but it's one we need to answer because in 100 years from now, those subsequent generations are going to turn and look at us and wonder what we did or didn't do makes it possible for them to live or not live in the places that we love.
We here are so proprietary about Gifford Pinchot that we think about Gifford Pinchot here, but Washington State, the Gifford Pinchot Forest,
Tell
us a little bit about what took place there at the dedication and what questions were asked, and you almost give Cornelia the last word in the book.
Oh, yeah, quite deliberate. First of all, she liked having the last word, so I'm going to give it to her. But for folks listening in, Cornelia Bryce Pinchot was Gifford Pinchot's wife and an extraordinary woman on her own right. A suffragette back in the day, but long before she married Pinchot, she was, as Teddy Roosevelt declared of her, the smartest political analyst he had ever met, and he did not genderize it. It wasn't the smartest woman, it was the smartest political analyst. So it's fascinating to me that that's who Gifford Pinchot married and who wanted to marry him, and what a dynamo couple. Pretty kind of amazing. You know, long before Franklin and Eleanor, long before Bill and Hillary, and then Hillary and Bill, there was Gifford and Cornelia and Gifford. And she went to the dedication of the Gifford Pinchot National Forest in Washington, outside of Portland, in the state of Washington, when it was rededicating Gifford's honor after his death. And the most striking thing to me wasn't that the Forest Service honored her. I mean, that was the logical thing to do, is what she did at the podium, which is to critique the very agency that Gifford Pinchot founded, and to critique it because it was becoming, and she was right about this, way too interested in technical issues and scientific means and not enough with social justice, which is striking, right? That she would stand on that dais and call out the very organization that invited her to speak and say, yes, this is an important moment to dedicate to my husband who did so much for this organization, but let's not forget that he was not simply a forester in a scientific and technical way, but also a social critic and a person who believed deeply in what we would now call environmental justice issues, and which she feared post-war the agency would pull away from that kind of work and focus only on board feet and the production of timber. And she was right. And one of the places that was cut and cut again and overcut was the very forest that she dedicated to her husband. And yes, I wanted to give her the last word because it seems to me she has the first word, the first shot at an agency that was starting to move away from its original mission. But I think at the heart of that was her principled notion that these public lands, which she and her husband were so deeply fond of, and which their son, Gifford Bryce Pinchot, would also be involved with, even though he did not want to go in the family business, in the end he would at some level. You know, they were really quite aware of, especially at the close of Gifford's life and his wife's own in some ways, they were quite aware of the degree to which those lands were so deeply woven into the history of this country and the cultural value that they had, and were ready to critique those who did not fully appreciate the diversity of uses that human beings could make of those lands. And I think you know, her commentary in the late 1940s was as prescient when she gave it and as powerful today to read her speech, which is why I got it in there, is to go, wow, this woman had it all, and yet she still is speaking in language that we find useful, comfortable, and also provocative.
We often tend to be rooted in the extractive industries here in northeastern Pennsylvania, still looking below ground in the coal and so forth.
And that's part of the tension that they helped us understand, which is that, of course, the economy and our life depend upon resources, whether it's water or coal or through fracking, oil and gas. But the question wasn't whether that was true. It's how we want to manage ourselves in the management of those resources. Pinchot was probably the first to argue, and through the Forest Service sort of make the claim, that when you manage resources, you're actually managing human expectations. And one of the things he tried to convince those who were opposed to him was, look, you could go in and suck out every ounce of oil, gas, ore, grass, timber, whatever it is that you wanted, and then you're going to bankrupt your children and your grandchildren and turn the nation away from its own resilience to make it a much more brittle and unsustainable place. Or you can steward the resources, which actually means stewarding our expectations, our greed, and our sort of avarice. He fell for the latter, which was to say, look, if we want our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren to live as well as we have lived, we have better come up with a better system than the British or the Romans or the Egyptians or the Greeks or any other imperial culture managed, because they're gone. And they're gone, he believed, because they did not manage themselves and thus did not manage what made them possible to produce their civilizations. It's a really heady charge, and it's one that, you know, in the contemporary political realm, we're hearing a lot of discussions about why we need more oil and more gas and more timber and all of this without restraint. And the moment we let those restraints go, we start to destroy ourselves.
Dr. Char Miller, W.M. Keck Professor of Environmental Analysis at Pomona College in California. He is the author of the award-winning study, Gifford Pinchot and the Making of Modern Environmentalism, and a senior fellow of the Pinchot Institute for Conservation. He was speaking with us about his recent book, America's Great National Forests, Wildernesses, and Grasslands, with photography by Tim Palmer. Tim Palmer happens to be a Pennsylvania native. The book has been issued by Rizzoli. For more information on the web, rizzoliusa.com, rizzoliusa.com. And for more information about Dr. Miller and to be connected to some of his writings and more, on the web at pomona.edu, pomona.edu. And you can find more at pomona.edu. There will be a link to Dr. Miller's own website. The book is America's Great National Forests, Wildernesses, and Grasslands, with photography by Tim Palmer, the text by our guest today, Dr. Miller, and for more information on the web, pomona.edu, pomona.edu. Thank you. And Dr. Miller urged us, if we haven't, to visit Gray Towers in Milford, here in northeastern Pennsylvania, the family home of Gifford Pinchot, who was the first chief of the U.S. Forest Service and who served two times as the governor of Pennsylvania. For more information on the web, graytowers.org, graytowers.org.